This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. The coronavirus has disrupted normal life on so many levels. That includes high school sports, which, for some talented student-athletes, offers a path to higher education that they might not otherwise be able to afford. But what happens when the pandemic puts their sports season on hold? How do they show off their skills for collegiate scouts? Joining us now to talk more about that is Richard Hanley, Associate Professor of Journalism at Quinnipiac University. Welcome back to The Full Story.
Good to be here, Tom. Thank you.
Professor, you've kept an eye on scholastic sports in Connecticut for quite some time, and you've seen a number of high school sports seasons come and go. Does this year's disruptions compare to anything you've seen in the past?
There's nothing in, you know, my lived experience. I mean, there were certainly some dislocations during World War II when high schools had to adjust to circumstances, but sports weren't canceled. High school sports were still played, but there's really been nothing in my experience or in my research that suggests anything like this has happened before.
And have certain sports, football, basketball, have certain sports been harder hit by the shutdowns than others? Is there a way to compare that?
Well, football has been hit the hardest in the sense that the season was canceled. Football is a major sport in high school. It has lots of participants, thousands of participants in Connecticut alone. And that meant the fall season would not be one of participation formally for a lot of athletes. Certainly cross country and soccer were played and played successfully. They didn't have state championships, but they had conference championships, that sort of thing, to give the student athletes a goal to shoot for. And, you know, those seasons have wrapped up. And now it's on to the winter, and the CIAC, the organizing body and the controlling body of high school interscholastic athletics, is pretty much postponing winter sports for a while as the pandemic, continues to rage.
And how about the difference between female and male sports? Are women and men athletes, young athletes, impacted equally by the interruption in the seasons on high school level?
Well, it's only male football.
Sure.
In terms of the predominant gender that participates in that sport.
I'm thinking in terms of
play.
I'm thinking in terms of cross country and basketball and those kinds of sports.
Sure, women's soccer was played. Girls' soccer was played. They had some league championship games, recently. Boys' soccer was played. So it was the sports that were permitted to play all competed to some point, in terms of championships and partial seasons. Regardless of whether they're for boys or girls. The boys' sport most impacted was football because the vast majority of athletes are boys. And it's obviously a contact sport, and it's a sport where the risk of transmission was determined to be higher than that of some others.
Especially for high school seniors, let's talk about football again for the moment. It's got to be disappointing to have their very last season, high school season, radically changed or eliminated altogether. Have you been able to talk with any students or hear from those who are in contact with these students, people who were hoping to compete for athletic scholarships on the collegiate level?
We've had some of our journalism students at Quinnipiac University talk to high school students for stories about what they're going to do without, having the capacity to perform for college coaches, in hopes of getting a scholarship at Division One or Division Two. Division Three doesn't have scholarships in college, but nevertheless, there are athletes recruited to play Division Three, and so the athletes and their coaches have come up with, ideas such as special training sessions that college coaches could attend to watch. The students be put through their paces, 7-on-7 passing drills, agility drills for the offensive and defensive linemen, that sort of thing, to give coaches a sense of the type of athlete these kids are. And Are they going to use that as a determinant to give a scholarship or to have a kid become a preferred walk-on or recruit for Division III? Probably not, but we live in an age of YouTube, and there are tons of footage of athletes from past seasons that can be used to assess, you know, whether or not the football player, you know, is capable of playing at a high level or a medium level. And the coaches know. They can tell. The athlete who's really been harmed is the late bloomer. That is the kid who's been playing JV, say, or has been on the varsity but hasn't seen much playing time, who suddenly blossoms. You're growing in high school, you're developing muscle mass, and senior year the kid may put on some muscle mass, may put on some pounds, and be really ready to play varsity, to start on an offense or defense, but then not have any tape to show because he's not playing. And so, I really have a great deal of empathy for that type of student athlete who just blossoms a little late in high school but loses that senior year. And psychologically, it has to have some damage as well. If a kid's been working hard for 3 years but not playing and finally has a chance to play but can't, that's got to cause some damage in some way to their mental health, as well as to their plans for college. They don't have that season to get better. They don't have that season to showcase their improvement. So I would hope that college coaches give kids like that a break and take a shot on them and say, hey, look, you're ready to play. We've seen you in workouts. Coach speaks highly of your persistence and your discipline. Why don't you come play with us? Now, it's not going to happen at Division I at the highest levels, but perhaps at Division III or even Division II, a kid like that who shows potential can get some status to play football in college next year. As it is, athletes like that are going to miss one of the greatest moments of their lives, and that is Thanksgiving Day football or the rivalry game during Thanksgiving week. That's really important to communities, and it's really important to the athletes. It's something they carry through their lives and so on and so forth. So missing that, I think, is really going to hurt. I think Thanksgiving morning is going to hurt a lot of kids and a lot of coaches this year. And it's a day that I think that they thought would be one they'd remember for one reason. Unfortunately, it'll be a day they're going to remember for another, and that's not having the ability to play in front of thousands of townsfolk and show their skills against a crosstown rival or the next town over, that sort of thing.
I'm talking with Professor Richard Hanley of Quinnipiac University. We're talking about the impact the pandemic has had on high school sports, and I'd like to switch gears just a bit, kind of look at the other side of the equation. Collegiate sports. Back in May, you wrote an article for the New Haven Register where you talked about the impact the shutdown had on college sports and also speculated where they might be in the autumn. Well, here's autumn. How does what's happening right now compare with what you were thinking about back in May?
Well, the Division II and Division III and the football championship subdivision aren't playing, so the only college football is football, a bowl subdivision. That's the top schools, Power Five, Group of Five, Stanford's, Notre Dame's, schools of that caliber, Alabama, Clemson. And it's been uneven. There's been a lot of postponements. There's been a lot of outright cancellations. And even though the Big Ten has started to play and the Pac-12 has started to play, to join the SEC and the ACC and the Big 12, which is, they've been playing since late September, there's still some sense of uncertainty among college football at that level, whether or not this year is going to have an asterisk because of the cancellations, the postponements, the late starts, the non-conference schedules, that sort of thing. So there will be a national championship round. There will be the four teams going to the playoffs, and two will meet in the national championship. But there's a sense that there's a lack of clarity. There's a sense that, okay, we got through the season, we survived this season, but it wasn't really a true college football season. There's been no fans or very few fans allowed at the game, so that color, that texture of college football is missing, that snap, with the bands playing, you know, is missing. I mean, it's certainly, outside of the athletes themselves, a hallowed experience. And it's one that students who attend these colleges, and some of whom attend it just to watch football. Folks, you know, go to Penn State because they want to take part in the rituals of a Saturday afternoon at State College, PA, and
you know,
they're missing that experience. So it's definitely different. There will be an asterisk, I think, applied at the end of the season to the champion, in the sense that, you know, it really wasn't a full season. It really didn't, you know, have the same sort of trajectory and flow. But nevertheless, they can hold their head high as a national champion.
With the uncertainty at both the collegiate level and at the high school level, when it comes to sports, football, let's talk about football again specifically, with that kind of uncertainty on both ends, what does that do to the transition of the high school athlete to the collegiate level? This sounds like something, certainly, again, as we've used the word before, unprecedented. What sort of confusion do you think this injects into that whole transition period?
I think it'll breed a lot of confusion. You know, a student, you know, I mean, hopefully there'll be a vaccine. Hopefully they'll play. Things will get back to normal next year. But students have to make decisions about where to play, who's going to stay. Say, for example, if you're going to an FCS school and somebody, a player, decides to stick around for another year of eligibility because they didn't have this year to play, well, that kind of blocks that student-athlete from starting. You know, so there's going to be a logjam at the FCS and Division II and Division III levels among students who elect to stick around and play because they're not losing a year of eligibility, and the incoming students who want to play right away. So I think coaches have a great deal of anxiety over this, over who to recruit, because they may not know who's sticking around, you know, or who's going to transfer in as a graduate transfer at FCS and Division II schools. So there's going to be a lot of confusion, I think, come spring, you know, when coaches try to assemble their teams for spring practice, find out who's staying, who's transferring, who's just quitting, not playing anymore, deciding not to play anymore, and an incoming class that you've recruited. How are you going to set this, you know, how are you going to keep your recruits on the team when they thought they were going to start or get significant playing time when they won't be? So I think it's going to be a rough year for both returning players, you know, and for incoming players at the collegiate level.
Would you imagine that there will be some permanent changes as a result of what the pandemic has done, both collegiate and high school levels, to the sports programs? In many other areas, talking about returning to normal is just not a thing. Normal is sort of out the window at this point, even when the pandemic is under control.
And when the pandemic is under control, college sports will not return to pre-COVID-19 days. You know, already schools such as Stanford and others have eliminated programs. The so-called Olympic sports, like gymnastics, say, for example, or swimming, that simply did not bring in revenue, that cost a lot. They just decided, well, COVID-19 is giving us healthy cover to cut these sports. And, you know, by that I mean, well, our budgets are stretched as it is. Why don't we start looking at what sports we offer and how we can save the athletic department some money? Because budgets are tight across higher ed, even before the pandemic began to rage. So I think collegiate sports will be dramatically different in terms of the number of sports offered at all schools in some way, shape, or form. And it's going, when a school like Stanford, which has this extraordinary tradition of excellence throughout its athletic department, but particularly in Olympic sports, you know, starts cutting sports that have yielded gold medal winners, then you'd have to think that, wow, everyone's looking very hard at their athletic departments for things to cut. And those are the sports that are going to get cut. They're not going to cut any revenue sports for sure, but others will. And those athletes will be harmed because there won't be as many places they can transfer to. And the high school athletes who compete in those sports won't have as many opportunities to compete at the collegiate level. So I think the landscape of collegiate sports will change, and that will ripple down to high school sports. I mean, high school sports are going to have to look at their budgets, look at their participation rates, look at everything. And this opportunity is one where they are going to focus intently, you know, on budgets. And unfortunately, that process will yield additional cuts in teams and personnel, which means coaches will get laid off and so on.
Well, all of these schools, as they're looking at budget cutting, then still have to keep in mind the requirements of Title IX, right?
Schools must comply with all Title IX regulations regarding gender balance, you know, among their athletic teams. And that will factor in any decision on what sports to retain and what sports to eliminate. Athletes, both men and women, are going to be harmed by this because it's just the nature of cutting stuff out of the budget. With Title IX, you have to make sure that the school retains among its athletic rosters the same gender balance as the institution. If you cut a men's sport, you're going to have to, you know, perhaps you're also going to cut a women's sport. If you cut a women's sport, you may have to cut a men's sport. And so that's going to be in the balance. That will be discussed. And ultimately, it means that all athletes will no longer have the opportunity to compete in intercollegiate sports, which for many has been a lifelong dream and for many drove their decision to go to a specific institution.
Professor, thank you for your insights today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Richard Handley is Associate Professor of Journalism at Quinnipiac University in Hamden, Connecticut. The rising number of COVID-19 cases in our region is leading educators to reconsider in-person learning and the start of the winter athletic season. Joining us now is Glenn Lungarini, Executive Director of the CIAC. That's the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference. And he joins us on Skype. Mr. Lungarini, hello. Welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
So this week, the CIAC voted to postpone the start date for winter high school sports until January 19th. Now, what sports does this affect?
The winter sports season includes wrestling, swimming, boys swimming, girls and boys indoor track, gymnastics, girls and boys basketball, ice hockey, both girls and boys, with wrestling, it's girls and boys as well, competitive cheer and competitive dance.
Wow, quite a few sports. In practical terms, what does the delay mean? How does it affect practice, meetings, actual games, other activities related to those sports?
So with all of our sports seasons, once we begin the first practice date, we have a 10-day period of practice prior to the first date of competition. So conceivably with a January 19th start date, you would be looking at practices at least till January 29th, January 30th. So, you know, practically speaking, your potential to start playing games would be that first full week of February.
And then the planning activities related to the practices, to the games, since I'm assuming those are all virtual online, that can be happening at any time?
All right. So for any of our sports, when we're not in season, we do have out-of-season rules that cover what coaches can and cannot do with their athletes. So the out-of-season conditioning programs that are permitted by CIAC rules are allowed to continue at this point. So we do want to try to keep our kids, whether it's virtually or if districts are allowing in-person conditioning to take place, then that's acceptable as well, just to try to keep the kids physically fit, enjoying the time that they could spend together in those activities, and keep them prepared for the winter season when we're able to begin on the 19th of January.
What factors did the conference take into account to make the decision to delay the season until January 19th? What things do you look at specifically?
Yeah, we have spent extensive time throughout the process planning all of the sports seasons and really considering at what point we would have to consider delaying potential seasons or events as well. So particular to the winter season. You know, it was anticipated from the onset of this year that we would see a surge in COVID numbers at some point heading into the winter. We were very fortunate to get as far along as we did in the fall, really completing our fall seasons. We had over 30,000 athletes compete this fall and have very good experiences in the fall. We are seeing that spike now that was predicted by, you know, most of the medical experts as we're moving into the winter season. So we're seeing numbers continually rise. We're seeing 7-day percentages now above 5%. And we're seeing more and more schools have to face the difficult choices of whether to stay in in-person hybrid instruction scenarios or move to full distance learning. And some of that is due to COVID numbers within communities. Another portion of that is that as teachers are required to quarantine for various reasons, there just isn't enough staff and subs to continue with instructional models. So we're seeing schools, for a variety of reasons, need to go out for extended period of times at this point as well. The other factor is I think the DPH has done a great job with their mapping, their classifications of where transmission rates have exceeded, the 15 per 100,000. So you're looking at the red communities, the yellow, orange, gray towns in their mapping. For CIEC, we have 186 member schools, and 144 of those member schools, as of today, are located in towns designated as red. We would expect that this week, as those numbers by DPH change, that may grow. So that was a significant concern as well.
How many voting members are there in the conference, and how does the voting work? Is it simple majority wins?
Yeah, we have 186 member schools, and the board is comprised of, we traditionally have 19 voting members. Right now we do have a couple seats open. So we have, at this point, 17 board members and voting members. Those members are all principals and assistant principals, active principals and assistant principals. So they represent different school sizes and different communities within Connecticut as well. And so any vote, that we take, any action that we take, is always done by a vote of those principals and assistant principals. So the CIAC staff, even myself as executive director of CIAC, I do not have a vote on any board or committee here at CIAC. It is all active principals, assistant principals, administrators, coaches that are involved in our various boards and committees.
And when making a decision, is the rule majority votes, simple majority, or is there a different way of deciding which way things will go based on the vote?
It's simple majority in terms of that. But again, the collaboration that we've had with the Department of Health, the governor's office, has really been terrific. They've been very open to discussions, and we feel we do have a pretty good handle. Also, we work with the Connecticut State Medical Society Sports Medicine Committee, and the doctors that make up that committee really represent a diverse group of practices, and they're just tremendous to work with. So we do, I think, have very good information as we go into these things. The decision to start on January 19th was a unanimous decision by the board.
Is it possible that the delay could be, there could be an additional delay based on what's happening with the pandemic, or is that date set in stone?
No, I mean, anything is possible. I mean, we're moving to January 19th because of the pandemic,
yeah.
Right? So otherwise, we would, be starting relatively shortly here with the winter season. But January 19th is the date that even for schools that are deciding right now to move to a distance learning format, the latest that we're seeing schools scheduled to come back is January 19th. So I think that there's a lot of confidence and optimism from our member schools, from what they're hearing from the medical experts that they consult with, their conversations with the State Department of Education, that mid-January is a realistic and optimistic date of return for whether it's in-person or hybrid levels of instruction. So that is, again, where we landed on being an education-based experience, that we want to have our kids and optimize that in-person experience as much as we can. And see January 19th is a realistic timeline.
You touched on this before, but I wanted to revisit it for just a moment. Are the athletes allowed to keep up their skills, so to speak? What are they doing to be ready even for practice in this downtime until the 19th?
Yeah, so with any off season that we have, our athletes are allowed to engage in conditioning with their coaches. So that continues. So the out of season conditioning is allowed to continue at this point. That does not include sports specific skill work, but they are able to, again, maintain physical conditioning, whether it's through weight training, cardiovascular work, cross training, plyometric work, variety of things that they can do to maintain their physical conditioning so they're ready to go from a physical standpoint when the start date comes.
Are all the districts throughout Connecticut affected equally by the decisions made by the CIAC?
Yes, and that's one of the, again, trying to give our districts very clear direction is important, especially at this time when they're faced with making so many decisions. The work and the stress that I think is on educators right now, from the superintendents to principals to the teachers in the classroom on a day-to-day basis, it's just extremely stressful for those groups, as it is for our students and our student athletes right now. So given a clear date that is brings equity to opportunities as well is important to us. So again, as we see schools going out for various points of time right now, who can play, who can't play, that date of January 19th is a realistic date of when we expect that all schools will be able to return to practices.
I'm speaking with Glenn Lungarini, the executive director of the CIAC. That's the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference. I would imagine that you hear from, students and parents about these decisions to delay or change schedules in their sports seasons.
You know, I think most are pretty understanding of it at this point. Again, what they're experiencing within their schools, I think, is very similar to, what you're experiencing now, where, you may be in school one day, but then there's an event and contact tracing has to take place, and you may be out of school for a day or 2 days. You may be out for 2 weeks. Some may be out a little bit longer. As I said, we're seeing schools now and boards now make decisions to go out until, for months at a time or to January. Unfortunately, with the spiking numbers in COVID right now, disruption has become a bit of a norm within the education setting. But again, we have great administrative leadership and teachers in Connecticut that I think are doing an outstanding job of continuing to engage the kids and try to manage them through these stressful situations. We understand the value of sport in that as well. And want to provide that, but we need to do it in a safe manner.
Who explains directly to the parents of the student athletes what's happening and why?
I think through that there's a lot of access right now, whether it's through social media, various news outlets, great radio podcasts and things like we're doing now, where I do think that the parents and the students do have pretty easy access to the information that's coming out. But the work that is done by athletic directors in Connecticut, we can't thank them enough for the efforts that they've made. I think our athletic directors and our coaches and the time that they put in through the fall is really what made that such a successful season. And the work that our athletic directors and our coaches will continue to do to prepare for opportunities for our kids in the upcoming seasons will also be a big benefit to that. So, their relationship, their direct connection with the kids, and they're the ones within each individual school that are having those conversations with them.
I recall earlier this year, I believe there were some protests at the state capitol from students who were not happy with changes to their sports schedules. Are you seeing any of that as you move the winter sports schedule to January 19th? Or perhaps it's too early?
Yeah. We're not at the moment. I think people, as they're, seeing and realizing impacts within their own school communities and how they're receiving instruction, looking at the numbers that are increasing in the state and, seeing our positivity rate climb, see our hospitalizations climb, see the deaths climb, it is a time that, again, I think we need to contribute the best we can to the leadership that our state has provided in terms of keeping Connecticut in one of the best COVID response states within the country. So, we need to do our part right now to keep our schools, student athletes, and our school community safe. But in doing so, it gives us the best opportunity to be back into athletic competition as soon as possible.
There are quite a few young men and young women who count on their performances in their chosen sports to connect them with the colleges they hope to attend, sometimes even getting scholarships based on their ability in a particular sport. Do you know how this is impacting their plans?
Yeah, I think that's probably as much of a question for the NCAA as it is for, any high school state association. And, I think when you look at the kind of environment of recruiting and when that process takes place now, with the exception of football, which I do think in football, the high school season is important to the recruiting process. But for many other sports where you have, AAU programs or club programs and various other programs that really play year round now that start kids as young as, six and under, seven and under, 10 and under leagues, that's where you see a lot of high school, recruiting or college recruiting, taking place. But some of the challenges that exist right now, the NCAA right now does not allow on-campus recruiting or coaches going out. So, you could play a fall lacrosse game this weekend, but you're not going to have college coaches on the sidelines watching. That's not allowed by the NCAA right now. I think another challenge will be with college athletes being granted additional years of eligibility in some sports. I think eventually you're going to probably see an impact to how many kids, scholarship kids, can be carried at Division I, Division II levels, how many kids just with on sport rosters can be carried scholarship-wise or otherwise, and what is the impact of a fairly significant number of students being given additional years of eligibility, which, again, the NCAA has been a good partner with CIAC as well as the state associations, I think, across the country. So they're doing an outstanding job. They're trying to manage this as well as we are. But, those are questions about recruiting that the NCAA will continue to give good guidance on.
And that leads to a question I wanted to ask you. Speculation here. Do you imagine that some of the recruiting rules might change as a result of what's happening during the pandemic? People talk about in various areas of going back to quote-unquote normal, and many people say normal is no longer what it was pre-pandemic. Do you imagine there could be some permanent change in recruiting rules with the NCAA given the pandemic?
Yeah, I think that would be very speculative at this point. And, again, the NCAA has done an outstanding job. I do think we've created a new norm that, moving forward, even when, COVID may not be as much of an issue as it is now, when we do have availability of a vaccine and, you could see this be controlled a little bit more. How recruiting happens and how the NCAA, handles that. They have outstanding people working up there, and I'm sure they're looking at that right now. But, to speculate of exactly how that would change, I'm not so sure that anybody has that answer right now. I was fortunate to coach Division I baseball for 7 years, and just in the 7 years that I coached there, we saw shifts in and where we went to watch players and, you know, and at what times of year. So recruiting and access to kids is always evolving, and the NCAA does a great job of staying on top of that.
Well, as a coach, as a former coach, you then have a, I think, a special perspective on this whole situation. How do you think coaches are managing through the pandemic to keep their teams together? I would imagine that's really challenging.
It is challenging, and I think the value and the benefit that coaches have is it is some of the deepest relationships that I think exist, particularly at the high school level. You know, the kids who are on that sports team, they all share a common passion and love for the sport that they're playing, and the relationship and the trust that is built amongst teammates and between players and coach, I really think is second to none in the educational setting. So even in challenging times where communication may be happening, you know, through technology via Zoom, you know, or in small groups right now, and where you're taking appropriate mitigating steps to reduce the COVID spread or reduce the risk of getting the virus, the strong bonds and relationships that our kids have, I think, have been extremely important in helping our student athletes deal with the social, emotional, and mental strains that a lot of the isolation necessitated by COVID response has caused.
Mr. Lungarini, thanks so much for your explanations and insights today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for the time.
Glenn Lungarini is executive director of the CIAC. That's the Connecticut Interscholastic Athletic Conference. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. Today we're exploring how COVID-19 is transforming the high school and college sports seasons. And with me now is Peter Turney. He's the Senior Associate Athletics Director for Compliance at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut, and he joins us via Skype. Mr. Turney, hello and welcome to The Full Story.
Yeah, no, thank you guys for having me here.
Sure. I understand you're relatively new to the job. You were appointed, again, a Senior Associate Athletics Director for Compliance in August. And maybe, first of all, you could give us a definition of just what that means in terms of the compliance.
Yeah, no, my role is to oversee all of the NCAA rules for the athletics department at the university. So, you know, kind of the big ones are, you know, the financial aid, the recruiting, and then all the other rules that relate to, you know, when we can engage in competition and practice. And yeah, there's just, you know, the rule book is about 400 pages right now, so they need somebody to go through it.
That's interesting. There's a rule book with all those pages. What has happened to the rule book in the midst of the pandemic? How has it shaped how you do your work?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they come out with something new just about every day or at the bare minimum every week. And so it's just we have to stay on top of things. And you know, I think we've done a pretty good job of that so far. It certainly has opened up, you know, lines of communication with other institutions and has actually been pretty positive just having everybody be on the same page and everybody kind of even, you know, in the competition season, we are competitors on the opposite sides. But kind of we've all worked together, other compliance offices and other institutions, to kind of pull together and make sure we're doing everything right.
So you mean the NCAA is coming out with rule modifications and changes on a regular basis? They've been doing this all during the pandemic?
Yeah, in fact, they started in March, and they've just kind of been updating these things, you know, as they relate to the number of hours you can practice, and all sorts of other rules, whether student athletes will get years of competition back, and even, you know, some of the recruiting rules as well.
But that's got to be a challenge to not only keep up with the rules, but to modify what the university is doing to comply with them.
Yeah, and, you know, that is part of the job. You know, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, most of our coaches know the general rules and kind of know what they should be doing. And then for all the really difficult stuff, that's what we're here for. That's what we want to do. And that's, you know, kind of the benefit we can provide to staff here at Sacred Heart.
How many different sports do you oversee in your position?
Well, we oversee all of them at Sacred Hearts, all of the varsity programs, you know, from football to track to hockey to field hockey, women's swimming as well. We have kind of our hands in all the sports that we conduct here.
And many, if not all of them, are Division One, I understand?
Yeah, all of them are Division One, and they all compete in the NCAA and compete for the NCAA championships every year. We're currently in the NEC, but, you know, depending upon the sport, we have different conferences for some of our other more unique sports and things like that.
You mentioned involvement with recruiting of high school athletes to the college level, to, in this case, the Sacred Heart University college level. We've been talking with some folks from the high school level, and they were explaining the difficulties in student athletes displaying their talents when in Connecticut the winter sports season has been pushed back to at least January 19th in terms of practicing and possibly competition. What does that do to the ability of a university recruiter to get a feel for student athletes that they might want to bring into their programs?
Yeah, I mean, so certainly normally this time of year, we would be in the point where we are looking at, our coaches anyway, would be looking at kind of the junior athletes that are coming up and going to be seniors next year and starting to kind of decide on who we're going to recruit and who we are going to focus on. And then, you know, also kind of trying to look at and determine, the senior athletes that haven't yet committed to institutions, you know, we would be starting to nail down what the roster is going to look like for the next year, the incoming class of freshmen. Obviously, you know, COVID, you're preventing competitions from happening and all the other things that go along with it mean that we've kind of had to rethink things, especially since one of the big rules that have changed, that the NCAA has enacted a dead period for all recruiting, which, you know, sounds a lot more serious than it is, but it effectively means that our coaches can have, you know, telephone conversations and other conversations and communications with prospects, but essentially all in-person, on or off campus communications are done until April 15th.
And as far as the coaches getting a feel for which students they might be interested in, high school students they might be interested in talking to begin with, do they get to look at, videotapes? Do they take testimony from coaches at the high school level about certain students? How do they replace the typical act of going to a game and watching a student perform in order to get a feel for how good they are on the field of play?
Yeah, and that part of it has been tough for our coaches. You know, a lot of times our coaches want to see an athlete in person to really kind of assess their abilities. And so that's been tough. Things have moved online a lot in those cases. So our coaches are watching, you know, live stream video. They're watching, you know, YouTube videos and best of and highlight reels that student or prospective student athletes have put together. And then they are relying a lot on the input from high school, travel team coaches, as well as, you know, there's a whole system of recruiting services that also assess prospects as well. So with the in-person viewing of prospects and recruits, you know, out the window for now, they have had to rely more on these other kind of secondary means of evaluating prospects' talent.
You mentioned before cooperating with other universities, schools that potentially are actual competitors during a regular sports season. Do you cooperate with them or share information with them when it comes to figuring out how to recruit during this COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, I do think the coaches actually talk quite a bit about kind of what they're doing in these spaces. Of course, coaches are always looking to get that advantage to get the best recruits. So some of the trade secrets they do keep to themselves. But they're getting very creative with the things they're doing. We are conducting a lot of things virtually and a lot of things over, you know, video calls, telephone calls, and even doing occasional virtual tours of campus. And I think everyone's trying to figure out ways that they can you know, give a prospective student athlete a sense for what campus is going to be like, despite not being able to be there in person.
You've worked at other universities in similar positions, I understand. So I'm wondering, given what you've seen in typical sports season years, do you think things will be changing? Anything will be changing permanently, even when the pandemic is over, in terms of the way, say, recruiting goes?
If I had to guess, I don't see much changing, especially since we are only a few years into a relatively new recruiting model where the NCAA and the coaches kind of wanted to get everything on the same page and date. So then now where we are now is the recruiting really begins, the in-person recruiting really begins junior year. And that's only a few years old, where now student athletes can come on official paid visits to an institution, but also come on other visits and also have meetings with coaches off campus, you know, at the start of that junior year. And so that's only a little, we're only a little while into that. So I would, were a betting man, I would say that they would probably try to stick with that for a little while and just to see how it goes, just because we've just recently brought everything together on this kind of junior year date. Now, that said, in the short term, I definitely think this next year, if everything keeps moving or starts moving positively and things start to open up again, there is going to be a little bit of a rush to have student athletes on campus and to get to meet these student or these prospective student athletes, you know, so that, you know, we can get the people that we want, but it's going to be kind of making up for lost time.
Mr. Turney, thank you so much for your time today, and best of luck in your new position.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Peter Turney is Senior Associate Athletics Director for Compliance at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, Connecticut. How about you? Are you missing the fall sports season? Let us know what you think. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter at @FullStoryWSHU. That's it for our program today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story. We'll be right back.